Here's a look at our top stories this hour. Ukraine says the ongoing conflict with Russia can only be resolved through diplomacy, while Moscow intensifies its offensive in the Donbass region. Russia bans over 960 prominent Americans, including President Joe Biden, from entering the country in retaliation for similar moves by Washington. Also, center-left leader Anthony Albanese claims victory in Australia's general election as the country elects its first Labour government in almost a decade. Thank you for joining us. Russia is pushing to take control of Ukraine's southeastern Donbass region after taking full control of the port city of Mariupol. As our correspondent Johnny Miller reports, Russian forces are moving out of Mariupol and heading for the heart of the conflict zone in Luhansk. Take a listen.
I'm currently just outside Mariupol, where the last of the Ukrainian soldiers in the Azov battalion are finally surrendering. It's a great victory for the Russians to take Mariupol, but the Ukrainians are also saying that it's a victory for them. Why? Because those fighters at Azovstal were able to hold off or take up time in the Russian army. The Russian army had to surround that steel plant for a long time, stopping Russian soldiers moving elsewhere in the war. And in part, that's correct. When we were coming up this road this morning from Donetsk, we had to wait by the side of a country road for about half an hour as an entire Russian battle group moved past us. Dozens of tanks, dozens of supply trucks, all leaving Mariupol now and heading to where the fighting is in Donbass and Luhansk. Right now, there, the Russian army is trying to encircle the bulk of the Ukrainian army. They're having success using artillery. Even Zelensky, who normally downplays Russian successes, has said today that it is, in his words, hell in Donbass as the Russians use artillery. Many of the Ukrainian soldiers in their trenches are dying without even being able to see the Russian army. This road here, we're heading back to Donetsk now. There's a straight road and there's a safe road because on the straight road, there is only about 4 kilometers away at one part is a village held by the Ukrainian army, and they often shell cars coming along. A reminder, the Ukrainians still hold huge parts of Donbass. But the Battle of Mariupol is over. The battle for Donbass and Luhansk is going to accelerate in the next few days.
The Ukrainian president says the ongoing conflict with Russia can only be resolved through diplomacy. In a televised speech, Volodymyr Zelensky said Ukraine didn't start the conflict, but it has to finish it, while he suggested that Ukraine can be victorious against Russia on the battlefield. Zelensky said a breakthrough can only be reached at a negotiating table. He also recalled Kiev's precondition for continuing talks that Russia does not kill Ukrainian troops who defended the Azovstal steel plant in Mariupol. The remarks come amid a deadlock in negotiations between the two sides. On Tuesday, Ukrainian negotiators said negotiations with Russia are on hold without substantial results. Later, Moscow accused Kiev of not wanting to continue talks to end hostilities. Russia blacklists over 960 U.S. citizens in response to Western sanctions. Leading Americans on the Russian Foreign Ministry's list include President Joe Biden, Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg, and Hollywood actor Morgan Freeman. The individuals are banned from entry to Russia indefinitely. The ministry says the sanctions are necessary to counter the U.S. attempts to establish, quote, a neo-colonial world order on the rest of the planet. Moscow has already blacklisted State Secretary Antony Blinken and Pentagon Chief Lloyd Austin. Russia, however, says it remains open to honest dialogue and that it draws a line between the American people and authorities inciting Russophobia. As the war in Ukraine continues, the West is taking measures spearheaded by the United States that would add more fuel to the burning flames. That's particularly concerning given the devastating toll the conflict is taking on the global economy. This begs the question, are we looking at a prolonged war in Europe? And if so, what would it mean for the rest of the world?
On Thursday, leaders of Sweden and Finland, two European nations that opted for neutrality for years, flanked U.S. President Joe Biden while he threw his support behind their bid to join the North Atlantic Treaty Organization, NATO, at the White House.
And today I'm proud to assure them that they have the full, total, complete backing of the United States of America. Today, my administration is submitting to the United States Congress reports on NATO accession, for both countries so the Senate can efficiently and quickly move on advising and consenting to the treaty.
The move comes amid objections by Turkey, a NATO ally, and warnings by Russia. Ankara opposes Finland's and Sweden's accession to the military alliance, citing their longtime support for groups Turkey deems terrorists. Moscow, however, has warned of retaliation if Finland, a country that shares a 1,340-kilometer-long border with Russia, joins NATO. Russia's deputy UN representative Dmitry Polyansky went so far as to say that the two nations could turn into potential targets for Russia if they become NATO members. Finland and Sweden say they decided to join the NATO and reverse decades of military non-alignment after Russia attacked Ukraine. But Russia considers NATO's eastward expansion a threat to its national security. The issue was a critical reason Russian officials say pushed Moscow to launch its military operation in Ukraine in February.
U.S. President Joe Biden is on a tour of Asia to bolster his country's influence in the region. On the first leg of his trip, he met with his South Korean counterpart in Seoul. The two leaders agreed to expand joint military exercises, a move likely to anger North Korea further. We'll discuss the issue in our news review program. Let's have a look.
U.S. and South Korean presidents have vowed to expand the scope and scale of military exercises by their countries to ramp up deterrence against the North. The South Korean President Yoon Suk-yeol and his U.S. counterpart Joe Biden met in Seoul earlier on Saturday. Biden said the 70-year alliance between Washington and Seoul was built on working together to deter Pyongyang. Biden is in South Korea on the first leg of his Asia tour that will also take him to Japan. His trip to Seoul met with protests on Friday and Saturday, with protesters voicing anger at the military cooperation between their country and the U.S. They argued that the cooperation would provoke an arms race. They also say that Washington's aggressive military strategy will escalate tensions in the region. Andrew Long is an independent China specialist who joins us from Hong Kong. We also have Daniel Lazar, who's a journalist and author, joining us from New York. I'd like to welcome you both. Andrew Long, let me first start with you. When you take a look at the stance that the U.S. and South Korea has taken in this case in terms of the joint military exercises, isn't that a failed strategy that has not really helped to not only ease tensions, but to find a solution towards the conflict with North Korea? Why do they continue with that without offering any hope to North Korea in terms of any type of rapprochement or warming of relations?
Well, for North Korea, obviously, the most important thing is not tension so much, but the Americas increasingly hostile aggression towards the country. And then North Korea has lost confidence and in fact trust in the United States attempts in the past to kind of negotiate with North Korea, even including the Trump administration's olive branch of walking across the border, shake hands with Kim himself. But then that all ended up in nothing. And then that all these negotiations that lasted for decades, the so-called six-party talks and so on. So for North Korea, the most important thing is to possess its own nuclear deterrence. Learning from or taking a leave from Chairman Mao's book when China was extremely poor but still prefer the nuclear capability to deter foreign aggression. Now, as far as South Korea is concerned, it's a new government, it's more pro-United States, but then the last thing they want is a war with North Korea, because the North Korea cannons, you know, hundreds and several hundred of them, are poised only about less than 100 kilometers from Seoul. So without even any nuclear weapons, all these cannons could obliterate Seoul in a matter of, you know, for minutes. But I think that what South Korea wants is, of course, is a military umbrella provided by the United States against a more influential China. But then the paradox is that the South Korea depend on China hugely for international trade and for investments. So I think that we're seeing a very nuanced situation. Both South Korea and Japan do not want a war, but they want American military cover. Mm-hmm. And then what the United States is trying to do is trying to create something of an Asia NATO to contain China, which of course is highly provocative, and then there's a risk of escalation.
So one of the things, Daniel Lazar, that the U.S. is trying to do, at least during this trip by the U.S. President Joe Biden, is to try to basically get support from the other regional countries in terms of the U.S. ambitions. But if I'm one of those regional countries and I take a look at what's happened to Ukraine, I'm not going to be that much of a supporter of the U.S. to go against China. I mean, that's my guess. What do you think?
Well, it swings both ways. I mean, the fact that NATO is lining up behind Ukraine, and NATO is actually expanding by taking in Sweden and Finland, suggests that that number one, that Ukraine has some powerful friends on its side, and therefore South Korea wants to make sure it has powerful friends on its side as well. I think the idea, the other speaker's reference to an Asian NATO, I think is really quite important. I think the U.S. wants to line up a solid block of nations against China, North Korea, and Russia. It sees those as increasingly allied with one another, and I think that's correct, actually. They have been drawn together by the Ukraine war. And so, therefore, the U.S. wants to make sure that its own ranks are solid, and so it's trying to firm up support in South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, the Philippines, et cetera. So we're seeing a polarization on both sides of the conflict between China, Russia, and North Korea on one hand, and the U.S., South Korea, Japan, Taiwan, and the Philippines on the other. And I agree, it's increasingly dangerous. We saw where this led to in Europe. It led to a major war. And it's certainly possible that it could do the same in the Western Pacific.
All right, we're going to have to leave it there. Thank you for that. Daniel Lazar, journalist and author. And thank you, Andrew Loing, independent China specialist from Hong Kong. And with that, we come to an end for this news review. Thanks for tuning in.
Welcome back. Australia's opposition Labour Party leader Anthony Albanese claims victory in national elections, ending nearly a decade of Conservative rule.
Tonight, the Australian people have voted for change. I am humbled by this victory, and I'm honoured to be given the opportunity to serve as the 31st Prime Minister of Australia.
Australia's outgoing Conservative Prime Minister Scott Morrison already conceded defeat. Morrison said even though vote counting is not complete, the opposition party looks likely to form a government. Early results show the Labour Party has won 72 House seats and needs 76 seats of the 151 of them to form a government. Albanese's election campaign focused on climate change and spiking inflation, coupled with the sluggish wage growth. Australia's inflation has surged to its highest in over two decades, leaving many people concerned about rising living costs. A new list released by British Daily Sunday Times, or The Sunday Times, I should say, says there are a record number of billionaires in the UK, with the richest 250 people worth more than half a trillion pounds. Released in the middle of a soaring cost of living crisis, this year's list has new entrants among them, a UK government minister and his wife. Watch.
The UK, home to some of the richest people on the planet. The capital, London, alone has more billionaires than any other city in the world. That's all according to UK Daily The Sunday Times Rich List. In this country, it says 250 people now own a combined $886 billion, enough to lift millions out of extreme poverty several times over.
It clearly shows that the capitalist system is not working, and obviously we are celebrating that there are so many more millionaires who have more than doubled or tripled their wealth in the last 2 years, while the poor have become really even poorer.
Many of the names on the list have been there for years. This year, though, two new faces. Chancellor Rishi Sunak, the man in charge of helping millions of struggling British families through the spiraling cost of living crisis, and his wife.
Evidently, someone of his wealth has no understanding of the crisis that the majority of the people are facing, We have 4 million people going to food banks. And the you know, the crisis, the cost of living crisis, is becoming very significant. By the end of the year, the ordinary people, the poorer sections of the community, may be even in more difficulty, while Mr. Rishi Sunak is laughing all the way to the bank.
The bulk of Rishi Sunak's wealth stems from his wife, the daughter of an Indian IT mogul. He also made his fortune working for Goldman Sachs and as a hedge fund manager in the past. We wanted to know how Britons felt about their chancellor now being one of the 250 wealthiest people in the country amidst the cost of living crisis that's pushing millions of people into poverty.
I believe it's not fair, particularly the way we found out, suddenly, out of the blue.
I don't feel particular resentment at people who have money, as long as they do their job and do their job well. No one would have known had not it been highlighted recently.
First published in 1989, the Sunday Times Rich List bears the names of 1,000 ultra-rich people or families resident in the United Kingdom. 90% of those on the list are usually men. At a time of record inflation, when many are struggling with energy bills, petrol prices and food costs, this golden era for the UK's super rich, among them now a government official, does not seem to be coming to an end. Saeed Purizza, Press TV, London.
This is IRIB English Radio. With you early in the morning. With you at midday. With you till the night's end. IRIB English Radio.
In Georgia, United States, Secretary of State Brad Raffensperger is fending off a challenger fueled by Donald Trump's election lies. But do American voters still care about the 2020 as much as the former president does? The article you're about to hear has been written by the New York Times journalist Maya King. The piece is titled, In Georgia, a GOP primary tests the power of a Trump vendetta. An anti-Trump Republican advocacy group recently organized a focus group of GOP voters in Georgia to get their take on perhaps the most competitive and consequential primary election in the state. They heard a lot of indecision. Most of the voters convened by the group, the Republican Accountability Project, knew little about the race between Brad Raffensperger, Georgia's Secretary of State, and his leading challenger, Representative Jody Heiss. Mr. Raffensperger seemed to get the benefit of the doubt until the voters were reminded of the backstory. As the state official responsible for certifying the 2020 presidential election results, Mr. Raffensperger rejected President Donald Trump's attempt to overturn his defeat. Trump then recruited Jody Heiss to seek revenge. Go Jody, I guess, said one voter in Georgia. 3 out of 6 others agreed. The exchange offered a glimpse into why the Republican primary race for the office that oversees elections remains a dogfight just days from the election day on 24th of May. 2 years after Donald Trump lost Georgia by the slimmest of margins and Democrats captured both of the state's open Senate seats, wounds from the 2020 presidential election have still not completely healed for some partisans. But marshalling the residual anger to unseat an incumbent is not an easy feat. Brad Raffensperger has worked to win back Republicans by casting himself as a defender of election integrity, even as he has spent hours debunking a laundry list of false claims about the 2020 election. Some voters' memories and passions have faded. Many never had strong opinions about their Secretary of State. It all has made the race one of the purest tests yet of whether the 2020 election lie can be weaponized to win elections. While opinion polls have shown that leagues of Republican voters in Georgia and elsewhere largely embraced the fiction that the 2020 election was stolen in its immediate aftermath, it is not clear those concerns alone or Donald Trump's personal vendetta are enough to drive voters' choices. I think 2020 was really a turning point in how closely people looked at things, said Sally Grubbs, chairwoman of the Cobb County Republican Party. Before, people might not have even realized that the Secretary of State was in charge of running the elections for the state, but now they're keenly aware of it. Jody Heiss, whom Donald Trump endorsed last year, is one of more than a dozen candidates running for Secretary of State under the America First banner, alongside others in battleground states like Arizona, Michigan, and Ohio. They share an unflinching loyalty to Donald Trump and a belief that the 2020 election was marred. Some are calling for a law enforcement arm to more aggressively prosecute violators of election laws. Opinion polls show large numbers of undecided voters in the race, with Mr. Heiss and Mr. Raffensperger neck and neck, each with about one-third of the vote. Both campaigns are braced for a runoff. Donald Trump's attempt at payback for 2020 in Georgia is floundering in the state's other marquee primary on Tuesday. Former Senator David Perdue, his pick to challenge Governor Brian Kemp after the governor refused to overturn the election results, is trailing Mr. Kemp in opinion polls and fundraising. Donald Trump has hardly weighed in publicly on David Perdue's prospects since hosting a tele-rally for the former senator in April. His former vice president, Mike Pence, is set to visit the state to campaign for Governor Brian Kemp on the eve of the primary election. Mr. Kemp has been adept at using his office to win over skeptical Republicans, passing a slew of conservative policies on elections, law enforcement, and education. For voters still enthralled with false claims of fraud, Governor Brian Kemp can point to the Election Integrity Act of 2021, which limits provisions like ballot drop boxes and mobile voting centers. When voters see that kind of activity around, the concerns they have, it just becomes difficult to drive an argument that people who are in office are being inattentive to the issue, said Brad Alexander, an Atlanta, Georgia-based political consultant and Raffensperger supporter, who was among several who argued that the potency of the stolen election debate has started to wane. In January, 43% of Georgia Republican voters said they were confident that the November elections would be fair and accurate, according to a University of Georgia opinion poll. By April, that number had increased to nearly 60%, and a record number of voters have already participated in the state's primary elections, topping more than 700,000 voters on the final day of early voting. We'll be right back. Jody Heiss, a four-term congressman, was one of the 147 House Republicans who voted against certifying the election results for President Joe Biden. He later took part in a White House meeting alongside Representative Marjorie Taylor Greene to try to determine how the election results could be flipped in Donald Trump's favor. He has claimed falsely that Mr. Trump would have won in Georgia if the election had been fair. At a meeting with the Atlanta Young Republicans on Thursday, 19th of May, Jody Heiss made unsupported claims about ballot harvesting, said he no longer wanted to use Dominion voting machines, and slammed Mr. Raffensperger for sending out unsolicited absentee ballots ahead of the last election. The voice of the people had been violated in 2020, he said. County officials in Georgia identified 64 cases of potential fraud out of the state's roughly 5 million votes in the 2020 election, according to an Associated Press survey of all but 11 of the state's 159 counties. But Mr. Heiss has tried to make his case about more than just 2020, raising the prospect of fraud in the future. This issue is not who wins an election, but the issue is absolutely, was it a fair election, he said. If the election itself is compromised or violated, then all the effort out there really doesn't matter anymore. And that's what we've got to defend. That's what we've got to protect at all costs. Most of the young Republicans in the room said they wanted to hear what Jody Heiss would do differently from Brad Raffensperger in elections, should he be elected. Even if you're not a dogmatic election was stolen person, there are a lot of people with reasonable doubt. And that reasonable suspicion is fair, said Chris Campbell, a 39-year-old national accounts manager at SmartFeeds. Raffensperger didn't address those concerns well, and people don't have confidence in him. But I do have confidence in Jody Heiss and trust that he would run the office with integrity. But there were clear divisions over that conclusion. Questions around the 2020 election, like was it stolen or was it not stolen, aren't healthy, said Alan English, the president of the Atlanta Young Republicans, who remained undecided between the candidates. Looking back at 2020 isn't productive, he said. Many Republicans declared Mr. Raffensperger all but defeated as soon as he announced he would run for re-election, citing Donald Trump's ire and that of many voters. Mr. Raffensperger was censured at a state GOP convention last year, but Donald Trump has been unexpectedly quiet about the race beyond lumping Mr. Raffensperger in with Mr. Kemp in statements railing against what he calls the rhinos, or Republicans in name only, running the state. Sarah Longwell, the founder of the Republican Accountability Project, which conducted the focus group last week, said that Donald Trump's limited involvement could be playing a role in some voters' indecision. Raffensperger has raised more money than his competitors, courting far-right voters and touting what he calls true conservative values. At an event hosted by the Buckhead Young Republicans, Mr. Raffensperger discussed the 2020 election, but said his office was focused on the real issue of preventing non-citizens from voting. Mr. Raffensperger has called for amending the state constitution to prohibit non-citizens from voting, something that state law already forbids. A state review found no instances of ballots being cast by non-citizens in 2020. Mr. Raffensperger acknowledges that his pitch has done little to pacify some Republicans. I was never public enemy number one. I just think that some people weren't pleased with the election results, he said. But in this race here, I'm leaving it to the goodness of my fellow Georgians who stood for the law, made sure that we followed the Constitution and followed the law. And that's all I can do. The roughly 15 people present at the event, mostly 20-something conservatives, were receptive of his message. While some still had concerns about election oversight, they said they appreciated his candor in the face of ongoing attacks. There wasn't anything that anyone else would have done to do anything, said Bradley Schober, a 27-year-old, an attorney who said he had already voted for Mr. Raffensperger. Ultimately, the guy took as much heat as anybody and came out on the other side standing. Despite the high interest in the showdown, less than $1 million has been spent on television advertising in both the Democratic and Republican primary races for Georgia's Secretary of State, according to Ad Impact, an ad advertisement tracking firm which the candidates exchanging attacks over the outcome of the 2020 presidential election and voting integrity. Jody Heiser's adverts have showcased footage of him and Donald Trump at a rally in Georgia, where the former president called Mr. Raffensperger a rhino and one of the worst Secretary of States in America. Mr. Raffensperger's advertisements have tried to rally Republicans against their common opponent, Stacey Abrams, the Democratic nominee for governor. The group she founded, Fair Fight, sued the state over discriminatory election practices in 2018. The lawsuit is currently in court. When Stacey Abrams attacked Georgia's elections, Jody Heiss did nothing, the advertisement's narrator says. The biggest spender on broadcast television has been B. Nguyen, the leading candidate in the Democratic primary, who has cast herself as a bulwark against Republican efforts to restrict voting access and meddle in the elections. When our voting rights are attacked, Ms. Nguyen says in one advertisement, we all lose.
Food for thought.
Hello, everyone, and here is something worth contemplating upon in the words of the leader of the pious and the commander of the faithful, Imam Ali ibn Abi Talib, peace be upon him. The portals of repentance are open for everybody. Hence, repent to God sincerely, so that your Lord may forgive your sins.
Iranian Radio, Global Mission. This is IRIB English Radio.
Thank you. questions and answers in Islamic upbringing.
I have a son. He's really in fond of football, and he's so weak in his lesson courses. I really don't know what should I do.
Could you tell me when we have to start upbringing our kids, that is, from the very beginning of the birth?
I have a little son, and he's so disrespectful. I want to know how to treat him according to the teachings of the Ahlul Bayt, peace be upon them.
Answering parents' questions in upbringing their children in an Islamic way.
Do you know what Islam is? It's a way of life for all. It is taught in the Quran for big and small.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio. Very warm welcome to the program Islamic Upbringing. This is your host, Zainab. I hope wherever you are, you're fine, you're doing well. And in case you have any problems, you're not doing well. In this holy land, we always pray for your well-being, inshallah. Thank you so much for listening. You're listening to the program Islamic Upbringing. In this program, we come up with the issues, the problems, the questions that parents have about the upbringing of their children. Well, the answers are based upon the Noble Quran and the narrations from the Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, and his purified progeny. We have in studio with us our guest speaker, Sister Salma Khalafan. Assalamu alaikum, sister.
Alaikum salam wa rahmatullah.
A very warm welcome to our program.
Thank you.
Thank you so much for coming.
It's my pleasure.
So today, we'll discuss about something that is recommended, that is suggested, that is being said that if you see youth is getting deviated, especially the Islamic Republic leader, Ayatollah Khamenei says, if you feel you're getting deviated as a youth, then try to go to more and more religious gatherings, try to attend them. But as the youth today, we see is avoiding these gatherings. Why? What do you think are the reasons behind?
That's one of the reasons that, you know, youths prevent going to the mosques. It's also a gathering, see?
Yeah.
But they don't like it, maybe because it's too much prolonged, or there are many factors that I'm just going to discuss about.
Yeah.
So in our view, many youths keep away from religious programs due to a number of factors. And I'm going to discuss two of these factors that are the most important ones. So first of all, there's a poisonous kind of propaganda that, you know, people have unleashed on our younger people for a very long time. The youth.
True.
That this has made them suspicious of our religious gatherings in the first place. And our spirituality.
Yeah.
Okay, as a whole. Because the facts are presented to them in a distorted manner. What facts? How are these facts presented? Through the speaker, the lecturer of the mosque.
All right.
So they are distorted. There's no systematically order in, you know, to guide the youths.
All
sometimes
right.
Sometimes you see a speaker come, he just talk, you know, things that are so like, you know, haywirely discussed. And the youth does not like that because maybe he's an educated youth and he would like to go in a systematic order. And sometimes he gets so confused, you know, hearing from one law to another law that have, you know, are unfamiliar to each other. And he feels, why this kind of conflict between the two?
And unfortunately, we have, it's very unfortunately late that we have some scholars today who try to start their lectures with a very, very long khutbah. With a very, very lengthy khutbah, which at the very first distorts the youth. They're like...
put off, right?
Yeah, they're like kind of fed up, like, I know how long khutbah you have memorized and all. So, because youth is not going to take that all. So, yes, there are certain reasons, I agree.
Yes, yes. So the way you recite the khutbah, as you said, yeah, you pointed out something important. I agree with you to that too. Like, don't prolong something in such a way with lots of Arabic, you know, words to make the person feel that you don't know anything, I know it all.
Yeah, yeah.
Right? So, this you intimidate the youth. You feel that I don't know anything, so what for? Like, I'm coming, I'm not understanding even the Arabic bit. So, a small khutbah could be a good start. And also, somebody who has the good information to give. And also, these days, the youths need to be inspired more than they need to be pumped up with information.
All right.
So a person might have so much to say and all our logical experiences, but they don't have the spirituality.
True.
Youths need that emotional spirituality too, because they have the information.
Yes.
They have these days the media, and there's so many sites that they can go to, and their books are all there, and they have so many groups that they could ask their questions to. But they kind of know the answers, but they need to be inspired.
Yeah, we have so many narrations from Imam Sadiq alayhi salam and Prophet Muhammad, may peace be upon him, wherein they say that this, it's the youth actually who has the better ever ground to accept all the spirituality.
Awesome.
Like no one other than youth has that beautiful ground to accept all that. I'll be talking to you, sister, here. We need to take a short break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
This is Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran.
Contact us at EnglishRadio@irib.ir.
Welcome back. You're listening to IRIB English Radio. This is the program Islamic Upbringing. And we are talking about why youth avoid religious gatherings. Sister, you were saying.
Yes, this was the first main important thing that, you know, like the way the information is portrayed, in what way, like the way you mentioned the khutbah might be too long, or maybe the whole lecture might be too long and boring. Maybe it's so dry, philosophical issues, which is not what the youth want, because when we are considering a lecture of everyone together, the youth, the child, the old, everyone together, so everybody needs that their share of knowledge that they can even like take something with them, like a risk, a sustenance, risk ma'anawi, something to improve by, right? Especially in the days of Muharram, the sacred days of Muharram. So we should select a speaker to inspire more than to just give information, dry information. And also, we should note the fact that when the speaker is speaking, he should not prolong his speech in such a way that the youth get bored. You know, the Holy Prophet used to give a lecture of only 30 minutes, it said. Only 30 minutes, Or some say even 20 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
Not more than that, because the brain capacity can take that much, and after that it gets tired and bored.
Yeah.
And when it takes that much and it applies, it's better than when you hear twice as much, and which is more informative, even if it is more inspirational, but you can't take everything. Your mind gets so exhausted. Unless, of course, it's a class, which certain people come with all their intention to receive something, to receive the Islamic knowledge. So that's different. But when a lecture is conducted, it should have this kind of rules.
True.
Another factor is that due to the effect that young people are so much distanced by programs of, you know, this kind of gatherings and going to the mosques and everything, is because of the lack of attention in Islamic principles itself.
All right.
You see that big man will start talking and joking and laughter in Shahadat days. So a youth will begin to wonder that I've come to mourn here, but look at these people. They're laughing. They're talking about their businesses.
All right.
They're not even paying attention. Or you see somebody rudely behaving. Don't take this. Take only one. For example, if they're giving the tabarruk.
All right.
No pushing. Or you're pushing me. You know, this thing kind of puts off the youth. So there should be an organized manner in such a way that these programs ought to be conducted for a youth to be inspired.
All right.
Yeah. That when we go there, there's so much organization. Everybody gets with respect the tabarruk. For example, people behave so much with etiquette. Everybody is ready to give space to you when you come. Not that you're a youth, go. There's no space here. You can go.
In the Quran,
when it says when somebody comes, you know, make space for them. So these kind of things put off the youth.
So these
are the main things, among other things, that I believe that puts them off from attending.
So you're actually saying that it's our conduct that also matters, the way we behave in these gatherings. Well, I'll be talking to you on that note. Here, we need to take another break. Dear listeners, stay tuned to IRIB English Radio.
يا مقضي الخيرات
The Prophet sallallahu alaihi wasallam said, "Raise your children to have three features: love for your Prophet, love for his household, and reciting the Quran."
Welcome back. You're listening to the IRIB English Radio. I have Sister Salma Khalfan with me, who is talking on the topic, why youth avoid religious gatherings. Sister, you said that we have narrations like our Ahlul Bayt, may peace be upon them, say that in case you are our followers, you are our Shias, when you are happy, in our happiness, when you are sad, in our sadnesses. But you said if there is a mourning, if there is some martyrdom anniversary and we are mourning, and you see these people, they are laughing stocks over there, and they are talking about business and other stuff, or they are avoiding them. We start our majalis, we start our lectures with the name of Prophet, who was himself, peace be upon him and his family, known for his akhlaq, for his ethics, for his morals and values. So where else do you think we are lacking that these youth get repelled from these gatherings?
Another factor might be is because, for example, gathering, one place of gathering which is of ultimate recommendation and beauty is the mosque of praying Jamaat Namaz.
All right.
The Salat of congregation.
Congregation,
right?
Prayers.
So when they go there, they see the Imam of the Jamaat praying so slowly.
Yeah.
And that puts them off. That here I can finish my prayer within 10 minutes.
Yeah.
This comes at a later, as you get acquainted with the prayers and you get an interest. So, you can't take a youth by force that, no, pray slowly. At least he prays. That's a big thing.
Yeah.
Then you explain the philosophy of prayers and everything. Very rarely youth are like that. And it's a very special quality for youth has that capability to pray slowly, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, they will come due to their own desire. But if people are encouraging, parents are encouraging their child to go to gatherings, then mostly the mosques should enhance that there's an Imam Juma who's so lively and good-charactered and ready to,
energetic.
Yeah, and ready to attract the youth through his namaz, which is proper, not fast, but not slow either. And when he even recites his dua, he doesn't prolong his dua in such a way that it makes the youth feel, look at his time or the pages that are left for the dua to finish. For example, dua Kumail. Usually we feel that this is one chance of forgiveness on Thursday nights.
Yeah.
So we encourage our children, let's go to the haram, let's go. But you see, many children, they feel it's just not ending. You see, it's just not ending. I'd rather read it myself. And they're right in a way. They don't have that capacity to sit for that long. We as adults even sometimes can't. So
what
of children, right? So yeah, let us shorten the gatherings of Azadari as well.
Right.
When Doha is being recited, there'll be about 8, 10 Dohas.
All right.
It's two Dohas with heartfelt, spirituality and
heartfelt spirituality is quantity matters.
Quality matters,
Quantity does not matter.
Exactly.
It's quality that matters.
Even one Doha.
Yeah.
You can never ever mourn enough for Imam Hussein.
Alayhi salam.
So even one, two Dohas are enough. And then you give them Tabarruk.
However, that should be heartfelt.
Yeah, and then that's why people, they feel that there's no use to go to the mosque. The Tabarruk is got at 12. And then you see people coming for Tabarruk instead of the real Tabarruk, which
the
is
real tabarruk
of the soul.
Yes,
right?
Exactly. Thank you so much, sister, for being with us. Thank
You're
you so much. Thank you so much for these beautiful points that we, as seminary students and so many imams need to take care of to attract the youth, actually, not to repel them from the religious gatherings. Inshallah, may Allah increase our capabilities to attend these gatherings more and more. Thank you so much for being with us. Thank you so much, dear listeners. You were listening to IRIB English Radio. To listen to that session again, you can go back to our website, parstoday.com, go to Call of Islam, email us your questions as well at the email, englishradio@irib.ir. And in case you want to follow us on the social media platforms, you can just search Call of Islam Radio and you can find programs there. Thank you so much for listening. You are listening to IRIB English Radio. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Do you know what Islam says? It says that life's the greatest test. It says that life's a borrowed space returned upon rest.
Cultural news, social news, scientific news, artistic news. With delight.
A print art exhibition chronicling nearly a century's worth of artistic achievements by a Chinese woodcarver has been unveiled in the city of Suzhou near Shanghai. The carved into wood exhibit features nearly 80 of Huang Yongyu's woodblocks and prints. Woodblock printing is a form of Chinese art dating back hundreds of years. In this form, patterns are carved out of thick sheets of wood to create a type of multi-layered surface. The ink is applied in various stages to print the image and its colors. The humble 98-year-old artist said during his years of practicing art, he learned that sincerity mattered more than technique. The exhibition was launched in collaboration between Suzhou Museum and the Beijing Fine Art Academy.
The lush green oasis near Sudan's capital, Khartoum, has turned into a haven for dozens of exotic birds from all over the world. The sanctuary shelters over 100 birds of 13 different species. Here, visitors can feed lovebirds, parakeets, rosella birds, and many more. The owner of the sanctuary says he trained the bears over the years to make them human-friendly. Akram Yahia says he has a passion for bears and enjoys it when people come around to see the sanctuary. The sanctuary, which is part of the Marshall Nature Reserve, is a welcome break for the people from their hectic life in Khartoum and nearby cities.
He tried to create an environment that doesn't exist in Khartoum. These environments exist in other parts of Sudan, such as in the west of Sudan, in the east of Sudan, in rainy areas. These areas have environments such as this one, and perhaps even more beautiful. He created this environment in Khartoum, where there is not nature at all.
Domestic and foreign tourists are allowed there only 2 to 3 hours a day. The limited hours are so that the bear's living environment is not disturbed. The owner built the 400-square-meter sanctuary 4 years ago. Over the years, he has added trees, garden, pond, and mist nozzles for cooling off against Sudan's scorching heat. Yahia says he wants to expand the reserve in the future. Indonesians have held a dazzling event to celebrate Vesak, a day traditionally observed by Buddhists in South Asia and Southeast Asia. People gathered at the sprawling Borobudur Temple in central Java and released lanterns into the sky. That's part of prayers marking the birth, enlightenment, and death of Buddha, a spiritual teacher who lived during the 6th century BC. The release of lanterns symbolizes letting go of negativity. The occasion lasts 3 days, which includes collecting holy water, sending off lanterns, and meditation. This year, the event was limited to some 1,200 people because of the coronavirus risk. Because of the outbreak of the pandemic, the ceremonies typically receive 20,000 people at the massive temple complex.
Tehran is hosting the 33rd International Book Fair in person for the first time after 2 years of lockdown as a result of COVID-19. This has caused enthusiasts to visit the fair for new titles. Saman Kujuri has the story.
The 33rd Tehran International Book Fair is underway in the Iranian capital, with over 1,700 Iranian as well as 170 foreign publishers attending the event. It is the first time after 2 years of lockdown as a result of the COVID-19 that the Tehran International Book Fair is being held both in person and online. As the top Iranian book event, the fair has millions of visitors every year, including thousands of university students, scholars, and their families.
I'm very happy to see that the book fair has once again opened its doors to the visitors in person after 2 years of lockdown as a result of the COVID-19. I love reading books. To me, the Tehran Book Fair is my favorite event.
For me, the book fair is an opportunity to get my kids familiar with books. I try to take them to different book fairs so as to teach them that book is a necessity in our life. I want to raise my children with the love for book reading.
A huge number of national visitors, along with international exhibitors from different countries, make this event one of the unique cultural events. The book fair is a good opportunity for publishers to showcase their new products.
We have designed our educational books based on augmented reality, which is an interactive experience of a real-world environment where the objects that reside in the real world are enhanced by computer-generated perceptual information, and students can watch educational films related to any specific topic. It will help students better understand educational topics.
It is said that books give a soul to the universe, wings to the mind, flight to the imagination, and life to everything. And this is exactly what the book fair tries to help you achieve.
By reading books, we feel healthy is the motto of the 33rd edition of the Tehran International Book Fair, which will be running through May 21st at Imam Khomeini's Musalla. Saman Kujuri, Tehran.
A group of over a dozen penguins has been released back to the sea after being given a second chance to live.
The condition of these specimens, which fortunately could be reinserted, is very common to find. They are animals that appear stranded on the coast, found with malnutrition, dehydration, hypothermia, and a high degree of parasitism. Specialists call this condition the stranded penguin syndrome.
The penguins were rescued and taken to the Mondo Marino Foundation, where they were rehabilitated. They were kept warm and were fed liquids until they could eat fish again. Before their release, blood and other samples were taken, and a chip was implanted to track them. One of the penguins was a southern rockhopper, which is a species listed as endangered. Biologists at a rescue center say there are many reasons why penguins get stranded and malnourished. These include overfishing, global warming, and other environmental changes.
The Light is a bulletin in which we bring you a lot of interesting news in different fields like animals' life, cultural events, funny trending news, and more from every corner of the world.